Will Miami give us rail or buses? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-Dade has a smart plan, and for years there was a promise of more rail. So what happened? We're joined by state legislator Keone McGee, who will discuss why he's pushing for more rail, and will also take your calls. Now, State Representative McGee also has something to say about the debacle with SunPass. He's called for the governor to halt all SunPass payments. He'll give us an update on that story. Plus, Jeff Caskey's a Parkland father who's getting political. He's now running the Families versus Assault Rifles Super PAC. It's an effort to make a ban on assault rifles a reality through political campaigns. And then we're going to dive a little deeper into the recent ACLU report that shows Black Hispanics are treated very different within the Miami-Dade justice system than white Hispanics or even non-Hispanic Blacks. That's all coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I think it's fair to say a lot of Floridians are facing headaches with their SunPass billing. The company SunPass contracts with SunPass contracts with for payment processing, Conduent, has been experiencing technical problems dating back to June. Last week, Democratic State Representative Keone McGee of Florida's 117th District joined Florida House Democrats in calling on the Florida Department of Transportation to suspend SunPass tolling. He's also called for an independent audit of FDOT's dealings with Conduent. And in about 20 minutes or so, Senator Bill Nelson is expected to announce at a press conference in Tampa that he wants a federal investigation into Conduent. McGee has made transit a major priority during his time in the legislature, and he's been a major advocate for rail expansion. There's a critical vote in August coming up with the Miami-Dade County Commission to determine whether bus, rapid transit, or metro rail expansion will be coming to South Miami. And we want your questions, your concerns. What do you have about SunPass tolling? Or when we talk about metro rail in South Miami-Dade, do you think rapid bus transit is better than metro rail? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Representative McGee, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thanks so much.
Louis, thank you very much for having me here, and it's truly an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to be here.
Two big topics. Let's start with the one that's been in the news a lot, obviously SunPass. Following the press conference last week, what was FDOT's response to your demand that the collection of tolls be halted until this problem is sorted out?
Well, it's the usual response. They did not have the authority to make that decision. That's something that has to come from the governor, from them. And secondly, they chose to continue to deal with this company that has shown that it has issues, major issues. As a matter of fact, over five different states have gone on the record to condemn the practices that were performed by this particular vendor.
Have you heard from the governor's office on what he might do on this?
Well, listen, the reality of it is there have been many legislators who have written to the governor asking for some sort of relief for our Floridians here. And unfortunately, we haven't gotten a response from the governor.
Do we have a sense of how many people are being impacted by this right now?
Well, based upon what we've learned from FDOT, we're looking at over 140 million toll transactions. We believe that if we were to equate that into the in form of the dollars and cents, if we're averaging $1 per toll, we're looking at least at the base, $140 million that we can honestly go on the record to say Floridians are being either billed, double billed, or hasn't been billed yet. Secondly, as it relates to the amount of people, only thing I can tell you is this. There are over 20.8 million Floridians in the state of Florida, and I can guarantee you at least half of them are using some form of toll roads to get from work, to pick up the children, to get to their VA appointments, and or just doing whatever social activities they may need to do.
That's the toll. It gives us an idea of the toll on people. What's the financial toll on the state?
It's huge. Let's be honest here. You know, we use our toll roads to help with infrastructure, to help with creating jobs, to assist with the tourism system that we have here. But unfortunately, we're seeing a decline in the number of people and their faith in government as it relates to properly billing them, properly assessing the problem, transparency, accountability. Those are the issues right now that are giving many Floridians major concern.
When were you made aware of the complications surrounding SunPass and that collection agency company, Conduent?
We found out when you all found out. This was something, and I believe that was about two to three weeks ago. You remember, FDOT chose to keep this in the dark. They chose not to send out letters to those who have been affected. What they decided to do, based upon the conversation we had with the undersecretary here in this region, is that they decided to send out information to email addresses, basically saying, hey, if you have a question about your tolls, please go to our website. But let's be honest, Lewis, right? If we're really having an honest conversation, the easiest thing would have been to do is simply come to you all, go to a radio station, send out a letter to the last best known address of their customers, and simply say, hey, we have an issue with our SunPass system. You may have been affected. Please call this number to verify whether or not you are a victim.
What are you hearing from basically, you know, your constituents? What are some of the things they've been saying to you about their experiences with SunPass? All right, you're laughing.
Lewis, they are upset. They want answers right now. Even Senator Tadeo, she attempted for an entire week to access the website, the toll SunPass website, to get some answers about her SunPass. I do have information from constituents who have already been double billed, and we know for a fact they have been double billed because we also know that we have the letter from Secretary Dew, who has gone on the record to say, yes, there in fact have been victims who have been double billed by this vendor.
What do we know about, I mean, FDOT was aware of complications that Conduent has had in the past in billing with other states. But do we know why they were still given the contract?
That's the million-dollar question, and I guess that's the gorilla in the room. Let's be honest. At the end of the day, what politics have become is a game of power, money, and access. So I can't speculate as to why they were given the actual contract, but what I can tell you is that I'm going to stick with my principle and say that power, access, and money equate to something that's more powerful than what the people are saying at this particular moment.
Tell us your experience in dealing with the Florida Department of Transportation. I hear different things from different people, but it almost feels like, and again, I'm just going on what I'm hearing, that it's this whole other world that almost operates on its own. It's difficult to ever get answers. But what's your experience dealing with them?
Well, it's a beast. And when you're dealing with a beast, you don't know what you're getting at that particular time and that particular day. You know, a beast has been known to be viewed as something that is out of the ordinary, something that's not productive, something that's brought about to destroy and create havoc. In this situation, what we're seeing is we can't get any fair answers out of FDOT. Legislators can't get straight answers out of FDOT. Constituents can't get straight answers out of FDOT. So it confirms what we've already known, that there are some great people within the FDOT system who want to see the system work. But unfortunately, new leadership needs to be had in order for that time to be realized.
Again, talking about this issue with SunPass, we've been talking about this, you know, for the past week here on WLRN, and I'm joined by Democratic State Representative Keone McGee of Florida's 117th District. Talking about the issue of SunPass, we'd love to hear your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with SunPass. If you had any luck getting through to get any answers, we'd love to hear from you. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Also, we're going to be talking about the smart plan here in Miami-Dade and the question of rail or buses. And we want to know your thoughts. We want to gather your thoughts now. Again, 800-743-9576. Is it better to have more rail or should we have more buses? Is there a mix in between that we could say, yeah, we'll pay for that? Again, 800-743-9576. Stay on SunPass real quickly. Is that you've asked for an independent auditing committee to investigate FDOT. All right, what would this committee look like? Who would be on it? How would it work?
Listen, the committee is simple. We have a bipartisan approach within the Department of Financial Services. We're asking, we don't care about politics. We don't care about views. The only thing we care about are the facts. So if we have Republicans, Democrats, independents, and folk who are from the community on this particular committee, that committee in and of itself will be a representative committee of the community to find out what are the true facts. What did FDOT know? When did they find out? Why did they fail to notify the people here in the state of Florida that there's a major issue with this problem, with this vendor? As a matter of fact, we've already deemed this and we've called it tollgate because we honestly believe there are some issues here that need some form of investigatory analysis done in order to bring the light out to the people.
I have to mention, too, by the way, we did reach out to FDOT as well because we'd like to hear their side of the story, and we have not yet heard back from them. What can the legislature do at this point? Because you talked about this is in the hands of the governor, but, you know, what's the next step if the governor doesn't take any action on this?
Well, two things are happening right now. We are in the process of sending out a letter, a joint letter, from the Miami-Dade delegation, legislative delegation. I am actually the chair of that, and also individual members have already sent out letters to the governor. So secondly, we're going to also see if there's some subpoena powers that we may be able to work with to help out and moving this thing forward and understanding what truly happened.
And as I mentioned, too, Senator Nelson about to make an announcement this within this hour, looking at a federal investigation. How would the state work with the feds on that, or is that separate?
No, we would love to make this a joint effort. However, I know the FTC and what the senator is requesting, they're looking at to see whether or not there was an abuse of power there. But from the state level, we can keep it as local as possible and simply say we know there's an issue because Secretary Dew has already indicated in his letter to the vendor that he, in fact, knows for a fact that they have been double billing. They have failed to follow through on their contract pursuant to certain sections of that contract.
The number again, 800-743-9576. I want to go to Mike in Fort Lauderdale. Mike, you got a question on SunPass.
Yeah, so SunPass, the monies collected are for road improvement. And the question I've got, you know, if that's collected for road improvement, then why is FDOT still getting tax dollars as well as federal dollars for road improvement as well? My understanding is that SunPass was a for-profit company.
All right. And
again, I know that Turnpike Operations is for-profit.
Okay. So, yeah, talking about the monies and where, you know, why FDOT is getting, making sure that what Mike is asking, why is FDOT getting other tax dollars? Where is this money going? I mean, part of it has to go to Conduent, but, you know, help us understand, Representative McGee, is like, you know, why we're getting double billed and where's this money going exactly?
And that's the question. That's the million-dollar question people are asking. Originally, the question that FDOT put out there was, well, if we were to suspend the toll, then how are we going to repay the bonds that we used to build these roads? Well, then the next question becomes then, well, what are you doing with the money that's coming down from the federal government? What are you doing with the money that we appropriate to you during the legislative session inside of the budget? So if they're saying that now, if we suspend the tolls to bring about relief for the constituents of the state of Florida, then the reality of it is what are you doing with the other funds? And so that's another question that has to be addressed that FDOT and the governor both refuse to address.
All right. Folks, you can still call in if you want to ask questions or have a comment on SunPass. I want to move over to the other issue that we brought you in for is obviously to talk about Metro Rail. There's a major vote coming August 30th that would drastically change the transit options available in South Miami. There's a discussion over extending the Metro Rail further into South Dade or funding rapid bus transit. Why do you see rail as essential for your constituents?
Well, there are so many reasons why, but the obvious one is there was a promise that was delivered in 2002. The county approached the people in Miami-Dade County and said this: if you decide to voluntarily tax yourself at a half cent, we would deliver to you in the north, the south, we would deliver to you rail. We would connect this entire county. We would make this, we would make the roads better. We would produce a better system, a coordinated system. I can honestly tell you since 2002, we've gone through at least three presidents, three mayors, probably countless governors, and yet they have only delivered 3 miles of the 88 miles that they promised.
Why do you think that is? What's happened over the last 16 plus years?
Well, it's called lack of political courage. You know, what we're seeing right now in this day and time is in 2002, the PTP half-cent tax passed. The money began to work. It were used to help with the system. In 2006, they decided to take the money away from the PTP and use it to fill the budget. Since then, that's where the money has gone, to the tune of over $2.6 billion. So we're not saying we're anti-bus. We're saying we're pro-promise. And the pro-promise sect of the entire county is simply saying we can move more people on rail. We can move hundreds of thousands of people on rail in a short amount of time that it would take the buses to do it.
And now the push that we keep hearing is for this new rapid bus system, that it would be better. Why not? Why wouldn't that be better? I know you were saying you can get more people on rail, but this is the push now. Why do you think that's the deal? And why do you think maybe buses won't be a better idea?
Well, because the county has shown that it does not follow through on its promises. You remember back in 2006, 2008, the county designated the South Dade corridor as a bus rapid transit system. They told the federal government that they were operating a bus rapid transit system. Today, what do we have? We have absolutely nothing. Secondly, the county has already cut 10 million miles of serviceable mileage in Miami-Dade County. Now, what does that mean? That means 10 million miles of service by the transit department is no longer existing. Lewis, you can literally travel around the earth in a spaceship 402 times. Based upon the amount of miles that have been cut.
You know why? Okay, let's go back to this though real quickly. One of the arguments is the cost of rail expansion to bus expansion. So they're saying it's going to be cheaper for bus expansion. So let's look at cost. You know, is that the smarter way to go, or do we need to ask more people to pitch in more? If you want that rail, we have to pay for it.
No, let's go on the record and say this. I will fight with whomever decides to ask the taxpayers of Miami-Dade County to tax themselves again. That's one. Number two, as it relates to the cost, I agree with the county. It's going to cost about $1.3 billion to build a rail. I agree with the county that it's going to take about 7 to 10 years to build the rail. And the reason why I agree with the county is because that's what happens when you're dealing with Miami-Dade County politics. They have found a way, Lewis, to waste resources and time. There are public-private partnerships out there who have helped build the tunnel, who've helped build the Dayland Center, who've helped build the Bright Line. They can get these projects done in 2 to 3 years at a reduced price than what the county is actually saying. So the numbers that you're hearing from the county, Lewis, is exactly supports our position that the county will find a way to not get something done because, again, let's go back to it. It's called paralysis by analysis, right? They will study everything and push things out in order for not to deal with it at that particular moment.
This should be a public-private partnership.
Of course. Would you trust the county to actually build something that they said they would have built since 2002? And here we are in 2018, really? Come on.
What kind of conversations are you having with rail companies? I mean, what are they telling you about the possibility of this sort of partnership and what they can do in Miami-Dade County right now?
Two things have happened. The private companies that we've had conversations with have gone on the record to say they can deliver the rail turnkey, ready to go. At most, it'll take them 3 years. They will give the Miami-Dade County 30 to 40 years to repay the amount of money that's used out of their pockets, out of their bank account, to erect this rail system here in Miami-Dade County. So we know that for a fact. On a second part of this is that we also hear that Miami-Dade County has pretty much told all rail builders that they are not interested in building rail. They want buses. So the individuals and the companies who want to be part of this system and revolutionize the way we travel here in Miami-Dade County have been told not to submit RFPs in order for them to give the county an opportunity to show exactly what they can build.
What do you think has caused this switch? Because we've heard many of the leaders we have right now, they were for it. They were for rail, and now they're not. What caused the switch?
Well, I can't speculate. As a former prosecutor, I was taught early on, McGee never speculate in trial or never speculate in court. But the facts speak for themselves, Lewis. It's a political season. Everybody's looking for their next political position. They understand that political positions require money and other resources to win. So the people are going to be victimized by those who are in leadership, their future goals and aspirations. And that is not fair. So my thing is, if we're going to do it the right way, let's remove this thing from the Miami-Dade County Transit Department, allow for the private corporations to come in and build this thing up so we can help with our system.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. Let me go to Roger, who's been waiting in Cutler Bay. He's actually a council member in the city. Roger, welcome to the program.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Doing good.
So, Keone.
Yes, sir.
Back in July 19th, the county commission was supposed to vote on this issue, and they deferred until August 30th, as you said. And that day, you told me when the meeting was over that you felt optimistic about that. So I got a two-part question for you. First, why were you optimistic? And secondly, what can listeners do between now and August 30th to get through to the county commission?
Thank you, Roger. And let me say this to you. The first thing listeners can do is to mobilize. We need a transit revolution here in Miami-Dade County. We need political courage. We need for them to find out who's on the TPO, tweet at them, email them, Facebook them, call them, do whatever, and let them know that they are watching. Number two, yes, in fact, I did feel optimistic. I am always optimistic at the reality of having folk take off time from their day of work to come down to the county and protest and lay out their views on a record of why they believe transit is necessary in the form of rail. And the reason why I was so optimistic that particular day is because I saw the passion that was being spoken from those commissioners who were on the dais, and they actually brought forth facts that contested what the Miami-Dade Transit Department had previously stated. So I was optimistic, and I believe we're going to have the vote, barring anything else happening in between now and then. But we need the people to continuously stand with us and continuously push the pressure on these individuals. And Lewis, let's be honest here. Notice that the reset date is August 30th. It's 2 days after the election. There are some county commissioners who are up for election. How convenient that instead of them taking the vote that day, when they knew they should have taken it that day, instead of doing it that day, Lewis, they waited until August the 30th to have that election, to have that vote. And children are going to be back in school.
Roger, thank you so much for the call. As we're wrapping up here, two other things real quickly is, one, after that vote August 30th, if they decide they're pushing more for the buses, I mean, what more can you do?
This is what democracy looks like. Democracy is loud. Democracy is something that must continuously go forward. We're not going to stop no matter what happens. We know that there are over 70% of the people in Miami-Dade County want rail. We know there are studies out there that simply state that the people have paid for rails and they simply want the county to follow through on that promise. So give them the rail. If we're really honest to ourselves and about ourselves, that many people are not pushing for buses.
The other thing I wanted to come back to real quickly, too, is this. You want to talk about a public-private partnership. How do we hold those private companies accountable to make sure that they are following through? Because as we were talking about SunPass, here we have this private company, and now we're having trouble with them.
Right. It's the same approach we took when we sent out the RFPs for the tunnel. Same process we did when we did with the Dateland Mall, the Dateland stations and the Orange Line. We have a body looking at their work, their past work. We also have a body looking at the contract and draft the contract in a way that is that helps us in the event that these people decide not to follow through on their promise.
That vote is coming up August 30th. We'll obviously be looking more into that upcoming conversation with Miami-Dade County Commissioners on the future of public transit here in Miami-Dade County. He is Democratic State Representative Keone McGee, who represents District 117. And coming back to SunPass, again, you know, we're staying up on this story. Senator Bill Nelson expected to make an announcement here this hour on looking at a federal investigation into that company, Conduent, that is processing those tolls. Representative McGee, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Lewis, thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, a new super PAC created that's going to take on assault weapons. It's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Parkland shooting launched the March for Our Lives movement. It's a campaign led by students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, registering young people to vote in this year's midterms. It's also launching a new super PAC in this year's elections. It's called Families versus Assault Rifles. They're not endorsing any particular candidate, but they will challenge anyone who won't support a ban on assault weapons. Now, the head of that PAC is Jeff Caskey. His son is Cameron Caskey, a Marjorie Stoneman Douglas student who helped organize the March for Our Lives movement. Jeff joins me now in studio. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me, man.
Hi, Lewis.
Tell us about the Families versus Assault Rifles Super PAC. How did this all get started?
Well, you know, as you correctly stated, our students have been very active and working very, very hard on this issue. But the parents also have something to say. And the students had their experience. My two children, my two sons who go to that school were basically trapped in a room with a bunch of other students during the shooting. And I, as a parent, had to sit there watching it live on television, texting with my son Cameron. And no, you know, one of the many, many feelings that has come out of this is that no parent should have to go through this. I mean, of course, no student should have to go through this. And no parent should have to be the one to be told that their student didn't make it out of the school. But we who are fortunate enough to have our children leave the school that day also have something to say.
And you had that, you know, I think back, you had that trip to Tallahassee talking with lawmakers. They had no plans to talk gun legislation. And then this tragedy happens and a law is passed. And the gun legislation hadn't passed in Florida in quite a while. But I mean, just real quickly, take us back to what was going on. Did you get a lot of pushback on that?
Well, I had nothing to, we didn't have anything to do with the Tallahassee trip. There were certain students and certain parents who did go on that trip. You know, you bring up an interesting point. This is a very political issue for some people. As far as we're concerned for the Political Action Committee, this is about safety. This isn't about red or blue. This isn't about a liberal, Democrat, conservative, Republican, whatever you want to call it. And you know, it's a shame that the politics have had to come into this, but they have. But our Political Action Committee is completely nonpartisan.
But isn't the topics that when you talk about the issue of guns, hasn't it become a red-blue thing over the years? Hasn't it really? I mean, that's how people have now separate themselves?
Well, and that's what I'm saying is that it has become that. And it's a shame that it has become that, because in real life, safety is not a political issue. You know, we wake up in the morning and we send our children to school and we go to the mall and we go to a movie and we go to a concert, and we don't want to be ourselves, or we obviously don't want our children to be mowed down by an assault rifle at any point in that day. What's political about that? It's become political indeed, as you said, Lewis, but in real life, it's about safety.
What is your take on the law that did pass? I mean, it a few things. One, raises the age of a person who could buy a long rifle. It does allow for schools to, it makes schools actually rethink safety, even though one of the controversial parts of that is that maybe some of the staff could be armed. But what's your overall take on the law?
Well, overall, I think it's kicking the can down the road. While there is a little bit about firearms in that law, there's a lot about other issues that are really red herrings. Hardening schools. Great. Harden the schools. Make the children feel like they're in Fort Knox every time they go to school. Make them have to show up early. My kids have to wake up in the dark in the first place to get to school. Now they have to wake up earlier to go through TSA to get to school. Creating the largest soft target of students, 3,300 students trying to go through whatever they're secure. I mean, some of it's preposterous. I think a lot of it is just a red herring to avoid the issue of the real issue, which is assault rifles, assault style weapons, military style assault weapons. And that's exactly what our Political Action Committee is out here to do.
You want to have a ban on assault rifles?
We want to severely restrict them. There's a federal act called the NFA of 1934, the National Firearms Act, in which machine guns, bazookas, grenades, those sorts of things are so severely restricted that they're next to impossible to get. They're not banned outright, per se. We want assault weapons to be in that category. We want to ban bump stocks. We want to ban high-capacity magazines. And you know, there's several different ways we can do it. If people will text the word safety to 99,000, text the word safety to 99,000, they get kicked back to our website, and all of our positions are laid out there pretty nicely.
Is this a fight against the NRA?
You know, the NRA is one of the many members of the gun lobby. The NRA isn't actually even the most extreme of them, if you can believe that. The NRA is the loudest. They've got they're most vocal. They claim to have 6 million members. I don't know if that's true. I can tell you that we have members of our political action committee who are also members of the NRA because they bought a gun and got an automatic membership, and they're trying to get off.
Are you?
I'm a gun owner, but I am not an NRA member. But I can tell you that if the NRA indeed has 6 million members, again, I don't believe it. But if they do, that means there's 344 million Americans who are not NRA members. And the other thing I have to say about that, Lewis, is that most NRA members agree with our position. Most responsible gun owners believe that there should be some type of control over this incredibly dangerous weapon that you can walk down the street and buy over the counter at a gun shop right now for cash.
Because the NRA has supported dozens of candidates over the years that categorically oppose an assault weapons ban outright, including Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis. Again, I mean, you know, you talk about their other groups, but do you foresee, you know, going into this election that you're going to push back? They're suing against the law the governor signed. Do you foresee, you know, any pushback from them on anything that you do?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we are not Second Amendment. The NRA claims that they're Second Amendment advocates. And again, I don't want to single out the NRA. All of our opponents who oppose our message of common sense gun control are a variety of different extremes with regard to the Second Amendment. We're not anti-Second Amendment. We've got gun owners, again, such as myself. You know, in addition to being a lawyer and the president of this PAC, I'm also a police officer. It comes with the territory. So, and I'll tell you this, and you know, I've only maybe mentioned this a couple times, but Cameron Caskey, who is considered, you know, on the forefront right now of the conversation of gun ownership, was at the gun range shooting guns when he was 8 years old, safely, with adult professional supervision. We have nothing against guns. We have nothing against NRA members. We, you know, what we're doing is we're trying to severely restrict these assault weapons, keep them out of the wrong hands.
We're talking with Jeff Caskey, a Parkland parent. His son, Cameron, as he has just mentioned, has been pivotal in the creation of the March for Our Lives movement. Jeff is president of the Families versus Assault Rifles Political Action Committee. And this is a group that wants to challenge politicians who won't push for more restrictions, as he said, on assault weapons. So how is this PAC going to work? I mean, we're coming up on the primaries within a month. And then, of course, this is a big midterm election that's coming up. Some people say maybe one of the biggest ever. But how is the PAC going to work? Where are you going to be directing your efforts?
Well, once the primaries are through and we know who's running for what, we'll have an idea of what their stance is on our single issue. And if they agree with the 80 plus, or depending on the poll you read, 70-80% of Americans who agree with what we're saying. Actually, most Americans agree that they should be outright banned, assault weapons. Again, we're just trying to severely restrict them. So once we figure out what each candidate is saying about this, then we'll know exactly how we're going to direct our funds.
Is a lot of the focus really statewide right now?
Well, Florida, you know, fortunately, Florida happens to be a battleground for this issue. So we are going to start statewide with Florida. Then we're going to branch out from there. We need people's support. We need people's financial support on this, because the more we have in our battle chest, as it were, the more races we can impact.
And also, just to make sure that I understand, I mean, the March for Our Lives has achieved a great deal of success when we talk about finances, getting a lot of support nationally and internationally. The Super PAC, I mean, where are you raising a lot of the donations right now?
They're coming from every state. You know, all we're asking people to do is send us $17, obviously to represent the 17 Stoneman Douglas Eagles who were murdered that day, or any multiple thereof, you know, to the extent that people can afford it and want to participate. But it's coming in from every state. We've gotten inquiries from outside the country. Because we're a super PAC, we can't accept money from outside the country, but we appreciate the support. We ask people to join, to go to our Facebook page and join the conversation. That's another way to support us. Families versus Assault Rifles on Facebook.
I know that you're waiting till after the primaries, but I mean, you look at the two big races in the state, the governor's race and, of course, the U.S. Senate race, with Governor Scott taking on Senator Nelson. I mean, do you foresee just putting a lot of attention and energy in that? Or you told me you're looking where you think you can make the biggest move.
Exactly. I mean, we're going to look at each race. And I have to tell you, I'm not the political savvy, the politically savvy operative here. We've got a great team that really knows what they're doing. But essentially, we need to be able to have an impact on a race. We need to be able to move the needle one way or the other. We're not going to waste money and invest in a race that we can't affect.
And it's not so much you're not supporting a candidate, but you're going to challenge candidates who don't agree with the idea of some sort of restriction, right?
Exactly. And we're not going to be supporting anybody, as you said. I could tell you that in the Florida gubernatorial race, for example, to the best of my understanding, the five major candidates all have the correct, what we're looking at for an attitude or a position on assault rifles. I've read their positions. They're all pretty much the same as far as the Democratic candidates. On the other hand, the Republican candidates both are gun rights advocates. Again, we're not against gun rights, but what they consider gun rights is going way too far as we're concerned.
Let's come back, because I want to get a sense from you exactly what, when you talk about restrictions, making it more restrictive to get an assault weapon, what does that mean? Paint a picture for us of what those restrictions look like.
Well, again, a great question. Right now you can go buy an assault rifle. You can just walk into a gun show, walk into a store, buy an assault rifle, and that's pretty much it. Maybe there's a little bit of paperwork. And by the way, don't even get me started on the issue of paperwork. The ATF can't digitize records because a certain gun lobby organization has made it impossible or illegal for them to do so. But that's a different story altogether. That's another issue. And I know the students are working on that. But what we think is that there should be some type of training involved. There should be some type of waiting period involved. There should be a check, a background check, criminal, mental health. I personally think, and this is just me, that it should take years to own an assault weapon. If you are so committed that you need there needs to be a needs test, because the assault weapons, according to four federal courts, are not protected by the Second Amendment. And by the way, for people who are unfamiliar with the terminology, this narrow category that's generally called assault weapons is used in 80% of mass shootings in this country. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the most dangerous weapon.
You talk about waiting period. My understanding is that is part of the new law. There is a 3-day waiting period. Is that enough?
A three-day waiting period is not nearly enough. I think the new law is a red herring. I think the whole thing was a setup so it could get to court. I don't believe anything that's coming out of the current administration in Tallahassee. I don't believe that it's in anybody's best interest except for the people who are promoting it.
Why do you think all of this has really started to build up steam after the Parkland shooting? We've had mass shootings for years. We had the Las Vegas shooting not that long ago. We've had school shootings, the Texas shooting a couple of months after that. We've had shootings in schools. What was different about this that we now see this massive movement of young people, especially, to push the needle in politics, to push the issue on guns? What's different now? What's happened?
You know, Lewis, right after Sandy Hook, I said, this has got to be it. This has got to be. I've been watching this for years, just like many adults have. And that to me was the breaking point. There's no way that this isn't going to move the needle. But that day when 26 people, mostly children, I mean, little children, 6-year-olds, were mowed down by a maniac with an assault weapon, those kids were too young. The survivors were too young to go out there and advocate. However, what happened in Parkland, what happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, where my two of my three sons go to school, that happened to a very vocal group of and a very intelligent and organized group of kids. And when my son Cameron got home that day and my other son Holden, and Cameron started his advocacy and pulled these incredibly talented students together. And by the way, it's not just the five you saw in Time magazine. There's about 20 to 25 of them that are out there working hard all day, every day. There's no way you're going to stop them. I've known Cameron Caskey since the day he was born and arguably before then. And he has never shut his mouth until he's gotten what he wanted. And I don't expect it to happen this time either. He's going to outlive us all. All these students who are doing this hard work are going to outlive all of the rest of us, especially the opponents, to their and our message.
Again, Jeff Caskey, he's a Parkland parent, and he is running this group, the Families versus Assault Rifles Political Action Committee, a group that wants to put tough restrictions on assault weapons. Jeff, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll have more information, by the way, on our website as to where you can find out more about this super PAC. Well, still to come, a new study looks at the racial and ethnic disparities in the Miami criminal justice system. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, a new study from the ACLU and the University of Miami found there are racial and ethnic disparities in the criminal justice system. Among the most significant findings of that study, the overrepresentation of Black Hispanics in the system compared to white Hispanics. It's called Unequal Treatment, Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Miami-Dade Criminal Justice. The report takes a look at data collected from 2010 to 2015, tracing the stages that defendants go through the life course of their criminal case, and answers the question of how criminal cases end up resulting in a jail sentence. Here to break down that study and talk about its findings is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Miami, Nick Peterson. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we've long known about the racial disparities in arrest rates nationwide between white Americans and people of color. But how is the information from this study changing the narrative and our understanding of the experience for Latinos specifically?
Yeah, I think what it's doing is really highlighting what people have already known sort of on the ground, that defense attorneys have heard, people have worked in the criminal justice system have heard about these stories for many years, and sort of moving that from the anecdotal level to the scientific level by actually collecting data and deciphering race and ethnicity.
I wondered, too, what makes this study different from past studies that look at the criminal justice system? Are we just really specifically talking about Hispanics?
I think that's a big part of it. That's one big finding that came out of the report, as you said, that Black Hispanics receive the most punitive punishment throughout all the different stages that we looked at. So arrest, bond, charging, and sentencing. And so I think that's a little bit of a unique finding to Miami-Dade County, given its racial and ethnic composition.
Does the study tell us why that is, though?
That's a great question. So that's one of the big limitations in terms of the study is that we don't really get into individual intentions or police officer perceptions. And so we're just sort of simply describing the patterns and saying, you know, here are the disparate outcomes that we observe, but we can't really get into the sort of mechanisms at the individual level. Although we do find that there are certain sort of structural mechanisms that produce these disparate outcomes.
How was the data collected?
So the data was provided actually from the county in collaboration with ACLU. So we requested the data, took, about a year or two just to clean the data, analyze it. So we have a whole team of researchers that were involved to try to decipher all of these different outcomes throughout the criminal justice system.
When you talk about a city where close to 70% of the population is Hispanic, what's the importance of looking at both race and ethnicity in this kind of situation?
I think to try to separate those two. Most studies have just looked at race. They've looked at, say, Black and white disparities. But as our findings show, it's incredibly important to also look at that racial and ethnic intersection, because Black Hispanic defendants seem to be the most disadvantaged. And there are a number of different reasons why that might be the case. Intergroup conflict, maybe representation in terms of criminal justice actors in the county. Again, we can't necessarily get into that, but there could be a lot of potential explanations for why that might be.
So, yeah, see, I want your take. If you can, tell me. I mean, you've got all this data and it shows the disparity. And I mean, you point out in so many different ways how Black Hispanics have it so much worse than white Hispanics. But what do you think why that is? I mean, is it a simple answer?
No, it's probably not. It's probably a combination of several different things. It could be potentially language barriers that Black Hispanics might have versus Black non-Hispanics. So there might be a language gap there. That Black Hispanics,
like when they're being arrested, when they're going through the criminal justice system, they're going through the courts, the language barrier could be play a role.
Exactly. Yeah. That Black non-Hispanic defendants might not be experienced, or at least to the same level. So that might be one factor. Just in general, we see that Black residents in Miami-Dade County and Black Hispanics in Miami-Dade County and throughout the nation have worse outcomes on a whole host of range of predictors relative to white Hispanics. So I think it sort of mirrors larger trends. The other thing that I was saying is it could be various group dynamics. The fact that most of the powerful criminal justice actors in Miami-Dade County are white Hispanic, and so there might be some sort of conflict there, inter-ethnic conflict.
Hispanic, white Hispanic office, police officers, white Hispanic judges. In other words, the people who are running the system.
Right. Exactly. And so there are some studies that have looked at other jurisdictions looking at, say, for example, how black judges sentence black defendants. And some of those studies actually find that black judges are harsher on black defendants. And so we might have a similar thing going on here in terms of the co-ethnic group, right? So that the judges might be more likely, Hispanic judges might be more likely, for example, to punish black Hispanic defendants equally because they sort of have this co-ethnic similarity there.
We're talking with Nick Peterson, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Miami and a co-author of this new study with the American Civil Liberties Union of Greater Miami called Unequal Treatment, Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Miami-Dade Criminal Justice. The study is looking at the criminal justice system here in Miami. So we talk about, let me ask you, the study found patterns regarding the neighborhoods the defendants live in. And what did you find in some of those trends?
Yeah, and so that was another big contribution of the study is looking at race and ethnicity, not just at the individual level, but at the neighborhood level. And we find that defendants arrested in areas that have a larger black population receive more disparate outcomes. The other sort of flip side to that is so overall black defendants or black residents are more likely to be arrested in the county. But that's even in predominantly white areas. So that is to say that if you're a black resident, you're more likely to be arrested overall, and even in areas that have a larger white population.
So are white Hispanics favored in Miami's criminal justice system?
The data would certainly suggest so, yeah. And so I think that's sort of the flip side of the fact that black Hispanic defendants are disadvantaged, that part of that comes at the advantage that white Hispanic defendants have. And so we see that they're actually the least representative relative to their share of the county population.
So really I don't know if there's maybe another level of study on this afterwards, is this question of the white privilege within the Hispanic community.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that has something to do with it. And the fact that, oftentimes there tends to be this sort of colorblind ideology in the United States. And I don't think that is... that also affects Hispanics as well, right? So the fact that there tends to be this kind of perception oftentimes that, we don't see race. So, for example, you see some Cubans and Cuban Americans say, oh, well, we're just all one Cuban race, right? But we actually see in terms of these disparate outcomes that there is a privilege that white Hispanics are receiving in Miami-Dade County's criminal justice system.
What do you hope that law enforcement takes away from this data?
To really try to identify and fix some of these gaps in the system that we see or identify as creating some of the most disparate outcomes. So the main one, obviously, for law enforcement is arrest, right? So if you're arresting a larger proportion of black people, then their likelihood of being convicted and incarcerated is therefore going to increase. And so one potential solution would be to focus on different types of crime. So we find that, for example, black defendants are more likely to be arrested for low-level drug offenses. So various parts of the county have tried to introduce civil citation programs for low-level marijuana possession. So that could be one potential avenue, rather than making an arrest, to try to issue a civil citation.
Why partner with the ACLU on this study?
This has been a topic that they've been interested in for quite a while. And like I said, their kind of constituents and people that they had talked to on the ground had mentioned that this is an issue that has been affecting a lot of defendants in Miami-Dade County. And we wanted to try to take that to the next level to sort of provide the data element of it. So we partnered with them because we want to try to see this study not just sit on the shelves and collect dust, but actually be implemented for specific policy changes. And so we've done our research now, and then the ACLU's perspective or agenda at this point is to try to turn that those findings into tangible results in terms of policy changes.
And again, as I mentioned before, Miami having such a large Hispanic population, but are there similar studies, or is there any way to compare to how, you know, the similar data to other cities with large Hispanic populations, whether it be, I don't know, LA, Houston, something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, Miami is a little unique in that regard that, again, it is the white Hispanics that make up the majority of the population here. So most of the studies that look at Hispanics are from, say, Texas, California, where the Hispanic population there is very different. Actually, there you tend to see that Hispanic defendants are disadvantaged relative to white non-Hispanic defendants. But here, again, we see this interesting dynamic that actually they tend to be one of the most privileged groups in terms of Miami-Dade County's criminal justice.
Nick Peterson, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Miami, also co-author of this new study with the ACLU of Greater Miami. It's called Unequal Treatment, Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Miami-Dade's Criminal Justice System. And we do, by the way, we've been doing reporting on this, so we have more of those stories at WLRN.org. Nick Peterson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, and that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.